Today in part 5 of our series, The Story, God Moves In. We study the Ten Commandments, the Tabernacle, and Atonement. What can we learn from the golden calf, the sacrificial system, the covering of sin, and how God wants to dwell with us? Here's Pastor Seth.
Well, if you've been with us for the last 4 weeks, we have been zipping through the Old Testament. We took 3 weeks in Genesis. We have creation and the fall of man and the change of human nature to our sinful nature. And then all through Genesis and the first part of Exodus, you have different pictures of what that looks like. What does our sinful nature looks like? Well, you see, there's the rebellion in our heart. And there's disobedience in our heart, which we sang about today. There is pride in our heart. And there is an unteachable spirit and arrogance and a stubbornness. All these things we see in Genesis and the different stories that we've looked at. But today, when we look at Exodus, I think of a word that's added to that list, and that's waywardness. We will really not understand who we are unless we realize that we are wayward at heart. There's something about us that just wants to go our own way. Now, last week we left the Hebrews. They were in slavery for 400 years. God did 10 plagues, including the Passover. Pharaoh finally said, "Get the heck out of here." The people went to the Red Sea. Pharaoh had a change of heart, chased them down. God protected them with a cloud, spent the night opening up the Red Sea. The people move across on dry land, and when the last little boy runs up the other side, the cloud parts. The Egyptian army, which had been in pursuit, runs down into the bottom of the seabed, and at some point the waves, the two walls of that great sea, come crashing down on the Egyptian army. And the people on the other side, looking back, realize they're not only delivered out of slavery, but they are free. It's an amazing moment. Now, you would think that if God did something that spectacular for you, that you would just be, "Man, I'm never going back on God. I'm never turning away from him. Man, I see his goodness." However, we are going to see that within a very short time, the people are wayward, fickle and wayward. So far, as we've looked at the story, there's our what we're calling our little story, where we look at our life and the things of our life and what we want to get, as we are driven by our sinful nature, curved in on ourself. And there's God's great story that's going alongside what we're calling the story. And God continually reaches down to us to try to get us to connect to his story and to be in relationship with him as a first priority. He does that not because he's lonely, but because that's how he designed us to function. When we live according to how he wants and when he is central in our lives, good things happen. That affect our relationships and our life and our attitudes, so many things. Now here today we're looking at sort of the back half of Exodus. And when I think about the back half of Exodus, I think of God moving into the neighborhood. We had a family that moved next door to us a few months ago. It was pretty cool. They're from a foreign country and got a cute little probably fifth grade boy that likes to throw the football around and play stuff out in the cul-de-sac, and sort of the whole getting used to the new neighborhood, and they just went on vacation for a couple weeks, and he came back, and we were talking, and he said, "Man, this is the first time I've owned a home, and I'm back there thinking, all in Florida, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, is our home safe?" And I said, "Well, hey, that's what I'm here for. You know, next time that happens, let me know where you're going. I'll get your mail, get your paper, take out the trash, all that stuff." And he goes, "Oh, thank you." Now, in this particular story, as the people have left Egypt and they're out there in the Sinai desert, they are now about 2 million people, and they are at the beginning of becoming a nation. A nation. When I think about our own history, I think about, we had the Declaration of Independence in 1776, the Revolutionary War, 1783, the war is over, we've won, and the Constitutional Convention comes together and they make the Constitution. Constitution was a really important document. The Constitution is sort of like the Ten Commandments. The Constitution provides the great framework of how our government is supposed to function. And it is, if you study political science, in my opinion, one of the great masterpieces of political science. carved out of mostly political theory that had not been tested yet. These men knew what they didn't want to happen, and they were trying to create a system that would make a difference for a long period of time. Exodus 20 is the Ten Commandments. But if you read Exodus 21 to 31, you're going to read a whole bunch of little minutia laws. And so if you think about our country, you have the Constitution, which is the great framework of our government, but all the states and all the local municipalities and counties, they enact their own smaller laws. Well, that's kind of like Exodus 21 to 31. But I'd like to focus just on the Ten Commandments first. James Madison is considered one of the founders of our country, but also the father of the Constitution. He was a brilliant, brilliant legal mind. And I'd like to read a quote that he stated when asked about the Constitution. He said, "We have staked," meaning the founders who wrote the Constitutional Convention, "we have staked the whole of our political institutions upon the capacity of mankind for self-government." Now, in our day and age, most of you, when you and me, when you hear the word self-government, we think of the government in general. That, you know, we're a democracy, and Lincoln's of the people, by the people, for the people. Well, that's true. But back then, 225 years ago, self-government meant something different. It meant the ability of the individual to govern himself, to do something about his own sin nature. And the idea that the framers had was that the greater the amount of self-personal government that the individual can do, the less need for the power of government in general. The worse that self can govern itself, the greater the need for structure and for governmental authority. This is why, as a nation, we started off with limited government. And the reason we did was because the founders, at that particular time in our history, saw a pattern for about 100 years that the people were pretty good at self-government. That's the Ten Commandments. Now, if you've ever raised a teenager, you've probably noticed that they really don't like rules. Not a big fan of rules. You know, the rules seem arbitrary and, you know, you just do it when you want to and you just say the rules and you change them as you want to. And, you know, the rules, it's tough, you know, raising teenagers with this. But teenagers aren't the only ones that don't like rules. Have you noticed that we don't like rules either? I like rules as long as they apply to somebody else. But my assumption is, I live my life as, I really don't need them. I'm good. But other people, I certainly need them. All I have to do is go on the freeway to remind myself of this very truth about myself. I see some kid whizzing down the freeway faster than the speed limit, and you know what I'm thinking? Where's the highway patrol when you need them? Get this guy. Throw the book at him. And there's a little bit of energy behind those thoughts. But when I'm speeding, no, I got to be there. They're counting on me. I got reason to be there. The rules don't apply to me. This is the same way it has to do with the Ten Commandments. When I think of the Ten Commandments, most people, probably in the secular world, see them as arbitrary. They hate the idea of absolute truth. It sort of implies a judge. And our secular society just loathes that idea. But from God's point of view, and what you should already see through Genesis and the first half of Exodus, is that human nature needs rules. We need commands. And there are two great things that commands are supposed to do. They are supposed to protect us from ourselves and from each other, and they are meant to provide for us. When I think about commands, I think about when we lived in Colorado as a kid. We would go up in the mountains and drive all, you know, just the beautiful Rockies, just breathtaking. And we always wanted to look out the window on these curvy roads, you know, with this cliff coming down there. And thankfully, the state of Colorado put guardrails on all those curves. There's a reason for that. It was to provide direction, to protect us. and to provide a great day for us. Exodus 20, we'll start here. We have the Ten Commandments. God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Now, you talk to a secularist in our country, this drives them nuts. Because it seems to them that you're just being too exclusive. And if anybody should believe in any God, that should be seem to be fine. And if people don't want to believe in God, that should be fine. Who are you to say that this is true? And who is God to claim you shall have no other gods before me? And this goes back to the design of human nature. The purpose of relating to God is not to be a religious people or a non-religious people. The purpose of relating to this God is to do something about my human nature. And the Bible is very clear. You can try any other God you want to, and you're going to find a hard time having your nature changed, becoming the man that you want to be, or the husband, or the father, or the friend that you want to be, the kind of character. In other words, what God says is, my design is to be central in your life, and that centrality in your life acts like a counterweight to your own human nature. When the winds blow this way, and if you're in a boat out on the sea and the winds are tempted to just roll over because the winds are so hard, this keel in you is meant to be a counterweight to keep you afloat, to keep you balanced. Number one, you shall have no other gods before me. Number two, you shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord, your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. What he's saying here is that sin is much more serious than my people see or they think of. There are consequences that affect their children and their grandchildren and sometimes great-grandchildren that you may never see. I do a fair amount of counseling for a pastor, and I see this all the time. Something that happened to you when you were a kid, and something with the breakup of your family, or something with your father that happened 25 years ago or 20 years ago, seems to have lingering effects in your life today. Something of what he's saying here. Following God is important, not just for you, but for those that we claim to love. But showing love to 1,000 generations, not just 3 or 4, of those who love me and keep my commandments, there's the promise of blessing through a line of people who will let God be first in their life. This goes by his design. Fight this and you fight the very design of how he made you. Number three, you shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses their name. Now the idea here is not just, I better watch my potty mouth. The idea here in this command is to a sense of reverence for God or respect of God. He's not just grandpa out on the front porch swing saying boys will be boys. Number four, remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. The seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. The seventh day is a time to refreshment and to remember God's work in our life. It's a day when we reconnect with God after a busy 6-day work week. This is important. It centers us again, week by week. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, your son or daughter, man, manservant, animals, alien within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that's in them. He rested on the seventh day. The Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Now, these four commands all have to do with sort of putting parameters on us. They're meant to keep us almost like a keel does with a ship in the water, to keep us moving in the right direction. The next six have to do with our relationships with God, with people. Number five, honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land your God is giving you. The idea here is that authority is a part of life, and learning how to be respectful of the authorities in your life, which starts with your parents and then goes on to people like policemen and firemen and city government and the military. If you happen to be a recruit and you have a drill sergeant, it's important to learn authority. This goes all the way up until the court systems. Importance of authority. Number six, you shall not murder. Now, for a long time, the Jews just thought that meant, you know, first-degree murder. But as Jesus will say later and explain to us, he is talking about murder starts in your heart. It starts as resentment. And it builds to bitterness. And it finally comes to a place of hatred. The reason that God says you shall not murder is that this kind of stuff just eats us alive. You will find so often in your day your mind wandering off to somebody that did you wrong. And you want them to pay. That's part of what it is to be wayward. It just comes so easily to us. This is something to fight. The next one he says, you shall not commit adultery. And as Jesus said, this is not just shacking up in a hotel with somebody that you shouldn't be shacking up with. Adultery has to do, again, Jesus says, with starting with our heart. He's talking about being faithful to the people in your lives with which you have made the greatest commitments to. The greatest one being to your spouse. Not committing adultery doesn't just happen if you at the hotel lobby, or doesn't just happen over lunch, the battle there. The battle really begins in your mind, and that's the place to win it, your thoughts. Next, you shall not steal, you shall not give false. And the idea of stealing there is it's easy for us to make possessions and things that which is most important. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. The idea here is once you start down the road of little bits of lies and white lies and stuff like that, it's easy just to keep going down that road to where not that many people really trust what you have to say anymore. Number 10, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant or maidservant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Now, what's interesting to me here is this command, even if you didn't see the other ones have to do with your inner world, this one certainly does. Coveting. And here he's talking about what goes on in your life, in your mind. What do you define as life and what you must have? And he said the propensity is to define that in all the wrong ways, with lesser things, instead of with our relationship with God. Now, again, you may think, well, why did, you know, maybe we need the Ten Commandments. Okay, I get that. But those people there, after seeing the deliverance and the Exodus, and they're free from Egypt, the great world power of the moment, why would those people possibly need commandments? Wouldn't they say to God, God, we get it. We see your power. We're committed to you. We're so grateful for all you've done for us. We're all in. While Moses is at the top of the mountain, receiving the Ten Commandments and the other ones from Exodus 21 to 31, something else is going on at the bottom of the mountain. We pick this up in Exodus 32. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, come, make us gods who will go before us. This is waywardness. In spite of all that God had done for these people. Well, in a very short time, I'm not so sure about all this. This plan doesn't seem to be working out like we want it to. We have some other ideas here, Aaron. As for this fellow Moses, who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him. And it's almost at this point you can see, I don't know, when I read this, you know, over and over again, it's just stunning. It's just stunning that we as human beings can be so quick to forget what God has done for us, and that we are just so prone to be wayward and to want to go our own way. It's just stunning to me. Verse 4, they said, after they made the golden calf, they said, these are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of Egypt, this golden calf made out of jewelry. Verse 7, Moses is up on the mountain with the Lord. And the Lord says to Moses, go down, get back down there, because your people, you know, God has a little sense of humor there. I'm not claiming them. I called them my people before, but hey, if you want them, you can have them. A little dry humor there. Whom you brought out of Egypt, same thing, have become corrupt. Occasionally, we've had at our house computers that have gotten a corrupt virus. It looks like a computer. There's all of the accoutrements of a part of the computer, but we just don't get it to work. There's something corrupt inside. I usually have to call Lance or Ben and get them to help me undo the corruptness. That's part of what here is exposed in our sinful nature. There is something corrupt in me that I just need to accept as truth. It should not surprise me. They have been, here's a second one, quick to turn away. Not just that we wander, but we're kind of quick to it. From what I commanded them, and have made themselves an idol, cast in the shape of a calf. They have bowed down to it. You can almost see God just going, oh. They have bowed down to it and sacrificed to it, meaning they have put that calf as first place in their heart. This is now the keel that drives them. And God sees disaster ahead, as we've seen over and over again in Genesis. These are your gods, O Israel, who brought us up out of Egypt, they say. I have seen these people, the Lord said to Moses, and they are a stiff-necked people. Another image of what our human nature is. We call that stubbornness. I want what I want when I want it, and nobody's going to make me do any different. Stiff-necked. God says, now leave me alone so that my anger may burn against them, that I may destroy them. Then I will make you, Moses, into a great nation. It's almost like, remember, with Noah back in the early parts of Genesis 6, 7, and 8. Maybe I should just start again, God's saying. Now, he's not going to start again, but he's having a dialogue with Moses, and Moses may not know that he's not going to do this, but Moses is kind of freaking out at this point. The next day, Moses said to the people, you have committed a great sin. Now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin. And here we're going to see that there's something that's going to be birthed, what we call the sacrificial system, which we'll look at in just a few minutes. The Lord replied to Moses, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. And here we have the clash of judgment and mercy. Judgment and atonement. Judgment that is deserved and mercy that is asked for. And what puts the two of them together, like a clutch in a transmission, is the sacrificial system. Now, the second thing, besides the Ten Commandments and God's law, is the tabernacle. And this is the point where God decides he's going to move in. And you know, when you read this, you think, well, that's a pretty good idea, because remember back in the Garden of Eden, it's like God walked in the cool of the day with Adam and Eve. He was right there, you know, kind of that image. And then it seems like for most of the rest of Genesis, and I'm speaking just in terms of human terms, not here, not theological exactness, but it seems like for the rest of Genesis, God is sort of back here and involved, but it's not he's as personally involved. That's how it reads or seems as in the Garden of Eden. But now we come back to this place where God says, I'm going to come back with my people. I'm going to live among them. And so he tells them to build them a tabernacle, which is a large tent where his symbolic presence will be right there. In other words, maybe you might be thinking, well, you know, God's invisible, and if we could see him, it might be better, we might think. And so there's going to be something tangible that the people can see, and through all the different fragrances that are going to come from that tent that they can smell, and the sacrificial system that they can be a part of, maybe that will make a difference to my people. Maybe they won't be so wayward. Exodus 25, verse 8. Then, Then have them make a sanctuary for me, and I will dwell among them. Make this tabernacle and all its furnishings exactly like the pattern I will show you. Now, if you've never read the last half of Exodus, and you try to do that this week, let me give you just a little warning. It doesn't read like the first 20 chapters of Exodus. Plot moving, a lot of drama going on back and forth. It is a lot of what looks like this tedious, boring instructions, and some of it has to do with the making of the tabernacle, this great tent. And when you read this, you sort of have to, instead of looking at all the details first and then look at the storyline, you have to remember the storyline first and then see the details in light of the storyline. So let me give you an example. If you read through those 10 chapters, you're going to find three things, I think. One, some very detailed instructions about the materials and about how it's to be constructed. Very detailed instructions. Now, why? Why all these detailed instructions? And here I think about that the sort of the implicit message is twofold. This is important. And you are to do things my way, not your way. And God's very serious about that. Not just in the building of the tent, but as a way of life. The second thing you will see is that the materials, the building materials, are stunning. It's sort of like the best of all that can be had, all the way down to things like the kind of thread that was used in the making of the tent. And all the accoutrements that are going to be inside there. And when I think about this, the word majestic comes to my mind. Or something of grandeur. That as the people looked at the tabernacle, and as it was being moved, torn down, and moved to different places, there was something beyond sort of our own human ability to even the nicest house to say. There's something grand about the character of God, something majestic about who he is. And then the third thing that can be the most puzzling is that there are very careful instructions as to how the tabernacle is torn down, how it is moved, and how it's set up. And God is very serious about that also. And when I think about this, you know, what's sort of the implicit message? And I think the implicit message is my people may be tempted to treat me in a way of just sort of as a trifle. Just kind of, yeah, we need to move the tent. Okay, who's going to do that this week? Okay, we'll get a couple guys and get a couple pickup trucks. And it's easy to sort of do that. And God says, oh, no, 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 no. You are not dealing with something human here. You are dealing with the Lord God. And there's a certain amount of respect and reverence that needs to go on with this. At the end of the chapter and the end of the book, Exodus 40, after it was all set up, the glory of the Lord filled the temple. And the people were astounded that there was something of the presence of God there. Now, if you read, if you wade through Exodus 21 to 40, you're done well. If you've never read the Bible and you're getting ready to read the next book of the Bible, if you thought Exodus 21 to 40 was a tough read, welcome to Leviticus. Now, I will tell you, I've read the Bible a number of times, you know, start to finish, you know, one of those year plans. And the first time I did it, I got stuck in Leviticus and got derailed. I think the second time I got stuck in Leviticus and got derailed. It wasn't until at some point in the past I thought, I am reading the book of Leviticus completely upside down. I am reading it like a Westerner does, looking for all the minute details as I work through chapter 1 and chapter 2 and chapter 3, try to understand all these things, and I have lost sight of what's the big picture of the book of Leviticus. And once I started thinking that way, then I had some context with which to read all the minutiae that is in those 27 chapters. Now, when I think about this, I think Leviticus 19:2 is the theme. Speak to the entire assembly of Israel. Say to them, be holy because I the Lord, your God, am holy. This is the theme. This is really important. And all of the book of Leviticus is to be understood around that theme. So, when you read the minutiae, how do you think about this? Well, if I had to put this in sort of God speak, I would put it something like this. My people have no appetite for holiness. That does not come naturally to my people. First thing. The second thing. So I'm going to surround my people with as many pictures of holiness as I can. From the most important things in life, their most important relationships, their most important decisions, their daily life, all the way down to the most stupid, small, seemingly insignificant things of life, so that whatever they do in a given day, there is a reminder to be holy. Number two, the third thing, my people are going to find it impossible to be holy. That's that wayward thing. Here we are again, unholy. Number four, I think God is going to say to the people through this, the hardest thing for me to do with my people is to make them holy. And already, just through 50 chapters of Genesis, 20 chapters of Exodus, that should be pretty clear. That's the hardest task of God, of all. The last thing, when I think about the book of Leviticus, I think, and God speak, he would say to us, this is the most costly thing to me in being in relationship with you. And it's going to cost you. Now, we know from our vantage point, eventually it cost him the death of his son, without which none of us would want to be holy. Leviticus. Then we finish with the sacrificial system. God's moving in with people. That's great. But we're screw-ups. We're wayward. So how does the justice of God and the holiness of God live with, in the neighborhood, with wayward man? And so God made a way for this to happen. It's called the sacrificial system. Now, if a secular person reads the sacrificial system today, they just kind of roll their eyes and go, it's just so hopeless. You know, lambs slaughtered and blood spilled on an altar and you have to do that again next week and do that again next week. And does that ever end? And, you know, it just seems sort of like that belonged in a whole nother world somewhere before. Now, how are we to think about that? When I think about this, I think that there would be, how hard is it for you to convince somebody else that they have a sinful nature? You ever tried to do that with somebody? You've got a fight on your hands. They're going to be mad at you. Because we hardly see our sin at all. And if we do, we think of it in such small ways, we minimize it so much and justify it, we are blind to it, that we just don't think, you know, it's not that big a deal. It's not until God says it's going to cost a life. It's so serious it's going to cost the shedding of blood that we think, huh? What? That's not how I think. That's how you think? That's how you see it? Something that serious? And so as you read through Exodus and Leviticus, you find different sacrificial systems that are set up, different offerings that are set up to deal for sin. But I just want to mention two. One, of course, the most familiar is the shedding of the blood of a spotless lamb, meaning a lamb there was no stripes and no spots on the lamb. They were to bring that as a sacrifice for sin. You and I would bring that. We'd bring that to the tabernacle. The priest would take the lamb and slit its throat, and the blood would be shed on the altar as atonement for sin. Atonement's a big word. I like to think of it as at-one-ment. At-one-ment. It's the process by which we are made one with God again through the shedding of blood. And the idea of the sacrificial system is that there's a guilty party that must die, but a substitute will be enough. Blood will be needed, and a sacrifice must be made. But in Leviticus 16, there's another picture here, what we call the scapegoat. Now, the way we use the word scapegoat is that somebody took the fall that didn't deserve it. That's how we use that. is sort of a derogatory term. Everybody knows it was somebody else's fault, but they just threw it all on that poor idiot down there on floor number 3. Leviticus 16, the priest is to lay both hands on the head of the live goat. You've got the lamb and slaughtered and now a live goat. He takes his hands and puts them on the head of the goat and confesses over it all the wickedness and rebellion of the Israelites, all their sins. He's verbalizing this for the people and put them on the goat's head metaphorically as an allegory. Somebody else is taking our sin. He shall send the goat away into the desert in the care of a man appointed for the task. The goat will carry on itself all their sins to a solitary place, and the man shall release it in the desert. Now, obviously, the goat doesn't have your sin and my sin. But what God is saying to the people is, I want to give you a visual of what I do when you make atonement with the blood of a lamb. Is I take that sin that you look at and you're tempted to go, oh, when am I ever going to get this right? And how come I keep disobeying? And I'm just such a spiritual screw-up. God says, well, of course you are. That's just something to be accepted and to deal with. But in the meantime, when you come to me for the act of atonement, your sin is taken off just like that goat is removed from your presence. The psalmist has the same idea in Psalm 103:12. As far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our transgressions from us. Now, you may look at this and say, it's not very fair to the lamb. It's not very fair to the goat. And you're right. And that's the point. Judgment meets mercy by the sacrifice of a substitute who sheds their blood in behalf of the guilty. One receives undeserved judgment. The other receives undeserved mercy. Does all this suggest something that will happen hundreds and hundreds of years later than the story that we're looking at here? There was a professor at a Christian college that was concerned about the people in his class, a lot of the class folks, because even though there were Christians there, it seemed like so many of them had such a weak view of the gospel. Really had a hard time seeing the import of it. And so he had an idea that for the last day of class, he wanted to throw a party. Everybody in the class could come. There were about 30 in the class. And he wanted to do something dramatic to show people the wonder of the gospel. So he told everybody on the last day of class, he was going to have several big boxes of donuts. You have some? That works. Bring them up. Wow. Ooh. Well, see y'all. Maple, glaze, blueberry, sprinkles. What he wanted to do is walk into class with donuts for all the students. He talked to his best student, a guy named by the name of Steve. And he said, Steve was a starting center on the football team. And he said, Steve, how many push-ups can you do? Steve said, oh, about 200 every night. Okay, in about 10 days, can you do about 300 in sets of 10? Steve thought about that, and he said, that's kind of a stretch, but I can try. He said, okay, good enough. So all the students came in for the last day of school for the party. Professor walks in with several boxes of donuts, and he goes to the first person. He says, congratulations. Judy, would you like a donut? She looks at the box of donuts, the tray of donuts, and she smiles and said, yes, I would. Before he gives her one, he turns to Steve and he says, Steve, would you go up to the front of the class and would you do 10 push-ups so Judy can have a donut? Judy takes her donut and all the class kind of laughs as Steve does his 10 push-ups. Kind of a funny thing. Hey, that's great. What a great thing. He goes to the next person, Joey. Joey, would you like a donut? He said, yes, I would. Steve, would you do 10 push-ups so Joey can have a donut? And class laughs, and he keeps on going down the first row to about 7 or 8 students, and he comes back to the second row, and by now, Steve's done about 70 or 80 push-ups, and he's sweating. Groups it sets at 10, but he's still okay. They get about halfway down the second row to Scott, who's a basketball player. And Scott's kind of got this figured out by now. He's a little bit miffed about this story. And he says, so the professor says, Scott, would you like a donut? And Scott says, I can do my own push-ups. Well, that's not what I asked. No, Steve does the push-ups. Do you want a donut? He says, no, I don't want a donut. Professor says, fine. Steve, would you do 10 push-ups for Scott here who doesn't want a donut? And he does 10 push-ups, and Scott, wait a minute, I said I didn't want a donut. That's correct, but he did 10 push-ups. Here's your donut. I don't want the donut. This is my class. You are my students. This is my desk. If you don't want the donut, that's fine. Leave it on the desk. Leave it on your desk. And there it sat. He kept going, finished the second row, he's halfway through the class. He's now going down the third row, and Steve has done about 150 push-ups by now. And he is laboring. And they get about halfway down the third row, and more kids are saying, no, I don't want a donut. The professor says, fine, Steve, would you do 10 push-ups for Sarah here for the donut that she doesn't want? So Steve does his 10 push-ups, leaves the donuts here. They finally get to the last row. He's done 28 students. There's two more to go. And the last two girls are in tears because he is obviously laboring at the end of this set. I mean, you can imagine this, you know, at the end of the, after all the set. And every push-up, just trying to, just to get one more in to get those 10. There's sweat all over him. There's sweat all over where he's doing his push-ups. And the last two girls are in tears. The final girl says, she's in tears, and she says, Professor, why can't I help Steve? He said, it's a great question. He said, when I decided to throw this party for all of you, I went back and looked at my record book and my grade book. And out of all 30 students, there was only one person who had a perfect record. Steve had 100% on the midterm. He had 100% on his final. And every quiz, he also had 100%. And all the rest of the students fell short of that. But how could I invite everybody to the party if only one person met the standard? I asked Steve about this. I said, Steve, when on the football team, when some of the athletes don't do what they're supposed to do, mistakes in games, what happened? He says, we do push-ups at practice. That's where this idea was born. Went back to the girl and said, Steve has to do your push-ups. He's the only one that got 100% in the class. She said, I'd like a donut. This little illustration in microcosm is what God had to do for his people through the Ten Commandments, the failure of the Ten Commandments, the failure of the people, even moving in with them and still wayward, and even with a sacrificial system. It wasn't enough until they saw somebody else doing push-ups in their behalf that they understood something of the mercy and grace of God. Let's pray together. Father, all of this, we can be so obtuse about all this stuff. Would you break through the hardness that's naturally in our heart, the crust that's around it? Break through our pride. Help us to see ourselves afresh today. Not as spiritual losers, which we are, but there's something deeper there. We are your children with whom you will not be satisfied until we are with you as beloved children, who enjoy your mercy and are grateful for it, and who delight in the grace that you lavish upon your children. Would you help us to live that way, to realize the wonder of the gospel, and that there's never a moment in our lives after confession that we need to walk in shame or with head bowed down.
We at Pacific Church of Irvine invite you to join us every Sunday at 9:30. You can also visit our website at pacificchurch.com.